I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
The strikes happened at night. We went out after hearing the sounds and we saw a fire there. Then we realized that Israel struck these locations. We didn't get a break from Turkey, and now Israel came. Israel has been striking the area for a while now.
After the historic collapse of Syria's Assad regime, Israeli forces bomb Syria hundreds of times as different Syrian factions vie for power. Meanwhile, Syrians are celebrating the regime's fall while grappling with the enormity of what happens next. We'll speak with Syrian-American political economist Omar Dahi. Then, as thousands of Syrians are released from prison, we'll look at a new report on Palestinian prisoners in the occupied West Bank from the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem. It's called Unleashed, Abuse of Palestinians by Israeli Soldiers in the Center of Hebron.
We interviewed about 20 witnesses. We took more than 20 testimonies concerning incidents that took place in Hebron in the summer of 2024. And those testimonies indicate that extreme violence amounting to abuse has become routine among Israeli soldiers in the West Bank.
And New York prosecutors have arrested 26-year-old Luigi Mangione and charged him with murder for the killing of United Health executive Brian Thompson. As many offer condolences to Thompson's loved ones, his killing has sparked outrage over the state of health care in the United States.
United Healthcare denials of coverage. Interesting that one of the shell casings had the word deny written on it. And it made me think of the time they tried to deny coverage for my mother's dialysis.
We'll speak with the People's Action Institute and with former health insurance executive Wendell Potter, author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military has launched a wide-scale assault on Syria after the fall of Bashar al-Assad's regime, bombing military sites, weapons warehouses, airports, army air bases, and cities and provinces across Syria, including the capital, Damascus. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reports in just the 2 days, Israel's carried out some 340 airstrikes. Meanwhile, the governments of Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar have condemned Israel's seizure of more land in the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan Heights, saying it violates a 1974 ceasefire. Israel seized the Golan Heights in 1967 and later annexed the region. On Monday, the armed groups who toppled Syria's longtime authoritarian President Bashar al-Assad said a Syrian transitional authority would be headed by Prime Minister Mohammed al-Bashir, an engineer who served as the fifth prime minister of the self-declared Syrian Salvation Government. We'll have more on Syria after headlines. The government of Austria says it'll begin deporting Syrian refugees following the revolution that toppled Bashar al-Assad's regime. About 100,000 Syrians have resettled in Austria in the 13 years since Syria's civil war erupted. Meanwhile, the governments of Belgium, France, Greece, Germany, and the United Kingdom said they would pause applications for asylum by Syrians. More than 14 million people have fled Syria since 2011. The largest share of refugees, about 3 million, live in Turkey. On Monday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan ordered the reopening of two border crossings in southern Turkey, where hundreds of refugees queued up to return to Syria. In news from Gaza, multiple massacres carried out by Israeli forces across the war-torn Palestinian territory killed dozens of people since Monday, many of them children. These included an Israeli air attack on a flour distribution line in southern Rafah and strikes on central Gaza's Nusayrat camp. In northern Beit Hanun, separate Israeli strikes killed 25 people belonging to two households of the Al-Khalut family, wiping the prominent Gaza family entirely from the civil registry. Israel is also continuing its deadly assault on Gaza's beleaguered hospitals. Dr. Marwan Al-Sultan, director of Indonesian Hospital in northern Gaza, called on international actors to help ensure the safety of health facilities after Israeli attacks injured patients and destroyed parts of the hospital. In the occupied West Bank, at least two Palestinians were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the city of Tubas on Monday. The victims were 26 and 32 years old. The attack came about a week after Palestinian authorities reported Israeli soldiers besieged the Tubas hospital, assaulting and arresting medical staff and patients. Meanwhile, the Israeli army detained at least 16 Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank Monday. Israeli forces have arrested over 12,000 Palestinians in the West Bank since last October. This all comes as the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has released a new report detailing the gruesome abuse by Palestinians by Israeli soldiers in the city of Hebron. B'Tselem documented the testimony of over 20 Palestinians, one as young as 14, who describe being beaten, sexually assaulted, and in one case even being stabbed by Israeli soldiers. We'll have more on this report later in the broadcast. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu returned to a courtroom in Jerusalem today to face multiple charges of corruption, fraud, breach of the public trust, and bribery. All three trials have been postponed on multiple occasions, first due to the COVID-19 pandemic and later as Netanyahu led Israel's devastating assault on Gaza. In one case, Netanyahu is accused of enacting regulatory decisions worth hundreds of millions of dollars to the owner of an online news site in exchange for a promise to drop negative stories about Netanyahu. In another case, Netanyahu is accused of accepting champagne, cigars, and other gifts from two wealthy businessmen in exchange for political favors. Ukraine says Russian artillery fire killed a 91-year-old woman in the village in the eastern Donetsk region on Monday in an attack that wounded four others. Separately, one man was reportedly killed and seven others wounded in Russian attacks on the southern Kherson region. Russia's latest attacks came as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky proposed a settlement to end Russia's assault, calling for the deployment of foreign troops in Ukraine while Kyiv waits for its application to join NATO. Zelensky made the proposal after meeting with Friedrich Merz, the conservative candidate for Chancellor of Germany, who made a surprise trip to Kyiv on Monday. After talks with Zelensky, Merz said that if elected to lead Germany, he would seek to send long-range cruise missiles to Ukraine.
Auch die meiner Bundestagsfraktion.
We want your army to be capable of hitting military bases in Russia, not the civilian population, not infrastructure, but the military targets from which your country is being attacked. And I said it a few weeks ago in the German parliament, with these range limits, we are forcing your country to fight with one hand tied behind your back. This is not our position.
Here in the United States, authorities in Pennsylvania have arrested and charged a 26-year-old white man with murder over the fatal shooting of the United Healthcare CEO in Manhattan last week. Luigi Mangione was apprehended at a McDonald's in Altoona, Pennsylvania, Monday after an employee called in a tip. Police found what they believe is a ghost gun and silencer, likely made with a 3D printer. Ghost guns are self-assembled with kits purchased online and do not carry serial numbers. Authorities also found a handwritten manifesto which reads, quote, "These parasites had it coming. I do apologize for any strife and trauma, but it had to be done," unquote. The manifesto also states he was working alone and condemned corporations that, quote, "continue to abuse our country for immense profit because the American public has allowed them to get away with it," unquote. Mangione is from a prominent Baltimore family, but appears to have withdrawn from his friends and family around 6 months ago. He suffered from a severe, debilitating back injury and has undergone surgery for his condition. He went to the Gilman School in Baltimore, an elite private school, and then to the University of Pennsylvania for undergrad and a graduate degree in engineering. Meanwhile, in New York, advocates have highlighted the stark contrast in the response to the shooting of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson and another fatal attack that took place one day later on a Manhattan street. 17-year-old Jeremy Colino, who was living at an immigrant shelter, was stabbed to death. Another teenager was also stabbed but survived. A group of assailants who are still on the loose asked the two teens if they spoke English right before the deadly attack. A New York jury on Monday acquitted subway vigilante Daniel Penny in the chokehold death of street performer Jordan Neely on a Manhattan subway train last May, finding Penny not guilty of criminally negligent homicide. 30-year-old Neely, a beloved Michael Jackson impersonator, was unhoused and hungry, crying out for help on the subway when Penny, a white former U.S. Marine, attacked him, pinned him down on a subway train by the neck for 6 minutes. Neely's family separately filed a civil lawsuit against Penny. Neely's father, Andre Zachary, was removed from the New York courtroom yesterday after protesting the not guilty verdict, along with others. Zachary spoke from outside the courthouse.
I miss my son. My son didn't have to go through this. I didn't have to go through this either. It hurts. Really, really hurts. What are we going to do, people? What's going to happen to us now? Had enough of this. The system is rigged.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, people. Let's do something about this.
And Nikki Giovanni, one of the most celebrated poets in the United States, has died of cancer at the age of 81. Giovanni was dubbed the Princess of Black Poetry after she published her first collection of poems, Black Feeling, Black Talk, in 1968. She went on to publish more than 30 books, including a memoir that was a finalist for the National Book Award and a children's picture book titled Rosa, about the civil rights legend Rosa Parks. Nikki Giovanni was a distinguished professor of English at Virginia Tech University, where in the fall of 2005, she removed a student from her introductory creative writing course and reported his disturbing behavior to her department head. That student would go on to kill 32 people and wound 17 others in a campus shooting at Virginia Tech, after which Giovanni became a fierce advocate for gun control. Democracy Now! Went to Virginia Tech to interview Nikki Giovanni. And then in 2013, Giovanni joined us in our Democracy Now! Studio here in New York, where she shared some of her poems.
Poetry is as necessary to life as salt is to stew, as garlic is to pasta, as perfume is to summer nights, as shaving lotion is to mornings, as your smile is to my happiness. Poetry is as significant to life as yeast is to bread, as butter is to toast, as grapes are to wine, as sugar is to lemons. How else will we get lemonade? Poetry is to me your voice, your touch, your laughter, that feeling at the end of the day that I am not alone.
Nikki Giovanni has died at the age of 81 of cancer. To see our interviews with her, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with Syria and the aftermath of the historic collapse of the Assad regime. Israeli forces are continuing to attack key military sites, airports, and army air bases in cities across Syria, including the capital, Damascus. In just the last 48 hours, Israel's carried out 340 airstrikes, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. A resident from Qamishli in northeastern Syria described the strikes that took place Monday night.
The strikes happened at night. We went out after hearing the sounds and we saw a fire there. Then we realized that Israel struck these locations. We didn't get a break from Turkey, and now Israel came. Israel has been striking the area for a while now.
Turkey and the United States have also continued to strike targets in Syria since the lightning offensive led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. In a message posted to Telegram Tuesday, the rebel commander, Ahmed Shara, vowed to hold senior officials in the Assad regime accountable for, quote, torturing the Syrian people, unquote. As different factions of armed groups vie for power and their international backers defend their interests, Syrians are grappling with the enormity of what has happened to their country and what comes next. In 13 years of war, over 350,000 people have been killed, according to the United Nations, over 14 million displaced. President Bashar al-Assad has now fled to Russia, where he's been granted political asylum with his family. Syrians are adjusting to the new reality of life after 50 years of rule by the Assad family, Hafez al-Hafez and his son, Bashar.
Today, we don't give our joy to anyone. We have been waiting for this day for 50 years. All the people were silenced and could not speak out because of this tyranny. Today, we thank and ask God to reward everyone who contributed to this day, the day of liberation. We were living in a big prison that was Syria. It's been 50 years during which we couldn't speak, nor express ourselves, nor express our worries. Anyone who spoke out was detained in prisons, as you saw in Sidonia.
For more on the dramatic changes in Syria, we're joined by Omar Dahi, Syrian-American economics professor at Hampshire College, director of the Security and Context Research Network, where he focuses on political economy in Syria and the social and economic consequences of the war. He was born and raised in Syria and involved in several peace-building initiatives since the conflict began. Professor Omar Dahi joins us now from Amherst, Massachusetts. Professor, welcome to Democracy Now! First, your response to Assad's departure, him fleeing with his family to Russia, and what this means for Syria.
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I've been watching, like many others from outside the country, in shock and disbelief in this past 2 weeks. And with mixed emotions in many ways. First, shock and disbelief at the collapse of the Syrian regime and the way it happened after 13 or more years of conflict, where there were front lines that were frozen for the past several years, but suddenly they disappeared. Of course, incredible joy at the personal level and also for millions of Syrians who were directly hurt by the regime, both through the violence of the war, the displacement, the killings and tortures that were taking place, as well as previously before the war. It's been incredible watching the scenes of the liberation of prisoners from prisons like Sidonia, which have been referred to, I think, correctly as human slaughterhouses. It's been incredibly moving to see people celebrating in the streets, people saying that they can finally go home, they can finally speak their mind. So all that has been really a joy to watch and witness as we kind of see the sequence of events unfold with the, you know, Bashar al-Assad fleeing to Russia. Thankfully, this process, which we can talk more about, happened finally with as minimal bloodshed as possible, even though there was plenty of bloodshed over the past years. But in the way it had happened, it actually provided a possibility for positive change, at least at the moment. But this joy is also tempered with lots of other feelings as well, primarily the costs at which this happened. And I would say the costs are the human costs that you outlined, which may be even more in terms of the people killed. Entire generations had been destroyed. There is a generation of Syrians that grew up in displacement in refugee camps. The destruction that happened to the country, all the human cost and the physical cost, I think it's hard to say that it was not too high. It's impossible to say that it was okay that all this happened. There are other costs, of course. The other cost is the loss of sovereignty of Syria, which has been a process ongoing for 10 years. Syria was occupied and invaded by the United States, by Turkey, on the opposition side and on the Syrian government side. It drew on its allies to defend itself, Russia and Iran, which came to place the regime in a position of dependency. So there were multiple foreign types of occupations in the country, which we see what is happening now in the Israeli airstrikes as a continuation of that loss of sovereignty. And I think this is something that Syrians have to grapple with. There are other costs of the war as well. There are the empowerment of actors that are not acceptable to a wide variety of Syrian society. Not that there isn't some backing for them, particularly because they have a certain legitimacy for many Syrians because they fought the government, but the current government in power or the current, you know, HTS is not acceptable to large parts of Syrian society, and there's already warnings that it's acting as a de facto power, and people are warning against that. And of course, there's the final thing, which is that this is tempered by the regional context, which is the ongoing Israeli genocide in Palestine that is empowered by the U.S. And we've seen over the past couple of days a complete destruction of what was remaining of Syrian army military assets by Israel with complete impunity. So all of those, we're trying to take all those contradictions together, joy for the people, joy for the moment that many millions had dreamed of, which is the departure of the Assad family from power, and the feeling that politics is finally possible in Syria. Despite all these contradictions, there is a chance for political life to resume. There's a chance for advocacy for a collectively better future. And this is something that we all have to try and, you know, hold and support.
Professor, I'm wondering if you could talk briefly about your own family's history. In the 1990s, your father helped smuggle out names of political prisoners, many of them accused of belonging to the League of Communist Labor. Yet the Ba'athist Party and the government of your country often talked about being a socialist.
Yeah, this was a kind of a spur of the moment post that I did on social media to share these documents that I received after my father passed away 3 or 4 years ago. Basically, my father was a lawyer and was among of two or three or maybe four lawyers who stepped up in the 1990s. To defend a large group of political prisoners, many of them communists, many of them who were accused of being members of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were basically detained without a trial, or not even just a trial, but without a formal charge. They were accused of belonging to this outlawed Party of Communist Labor, which was accused by the government of mounting an insurrection against it in the late 70s and 80s. So most of those who were detained in the 1980s. They had been disappeared. Their families didn't know anything about them. Most people didn't know, like many of the people we're discovering in Saydnaya prison today, were not aware whether they were dead or alive or their whereabouts. So my father would basically meet with some of those prisoners when allowed to do so. And really, it was the courage of the prisoners to assemble a lot of this data, to write down their names, their dates of birth, their professions, when they were arrested, what's their charge, where they were being held, mostly in this case in Saydnaya prison. And also, if they were in, they needed medical attention, they were, traumatized or they were injured in some way. And I asked my dad why he did this, actually, because, there was no sense that these prisoners would be freed. So most of them ended up being put on trial en masse and convicted. So he told me that he had no expectation of justice at that time, but that he felt it was necessary to do it, to use any opening and any chance to expose the hypocrisy of the government for the same reasons that you mentioned, that he didn't expect them to actually be, receive a fair trial, which they didn't. But there has to be a chance to basically, you know, put the government's declared principles against its actions and expose the government. So this was a historical document that I was kind of moved to share when the images of the prisoners were being released from Saydia. Most of those names in those documents have either unfortunately passed away or were released from the prison. So I didn't expect that there'd be actually some of those people actually there. But yeah, that's why I shared that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also, you mentioned the foreign presence in Syria. Hasn't the country effectively during this this civil war been already partitioned with Turkish troops creating a buffer zone in the north, the Israelis not only recently in the past few days entering Syrian territory, but conducting military operations in the territory previous to that with the Kurds backed by the U.S., ISIS still controlling portions of territory and the Russian bases in the country? How do you have any sense of the integrity of the country being reconstituted anytime soon?
I don't think so. I think it's going to be a long-term struggle, and partly because of the reasons you mentioned, because this is something that has been happening for a decade, and there are kind of entrenched interests that have developed, not just in terms of a foreign occupation, but in terms of the connection of various parts of Syrian society and their ties to those countries in ways that they've come to basically be affiliated or allied with them. And this is reminiscent for people who observe Syria of the post-independence period in Syrian history when Syria was a site of struggle by external powers because it was weak, it was politically divided, and various regional powers basically came to have significant influence in the country through Syrian political elites. This was transformed by the Assad family and the Ba'ath Party in ways that actually flipped this around, where Syria consolidated its power and projected its power, at least regionally. But it came at a price, I think, that was high and unsustainable, particularly for Syrian society. Now this has actually completely been shattered. And I think there's going to be an attempt to rewrite the history of the Syrian conflict in ways that pin the blame completely on the Assad regime, which I don't think is the case. I think they are primarily at fault for this, not just because of their governance, which was brutal and tyrannical and maintained an exclusive monopoly on power for decades without recognizing any dissent, without recognizing any political opposition, not just because of the reaction to the uprising when it first started, where they completely closed down any meaningful political transition, but also because even after they won the war, they spent many years refusing any political initiative to reconcile after they had, with the help of Russia and Iran, win the war, basically. So the front lines had been frozen for many years. But all the other international actors also contributed to the destruction of the country. I think there were ways in which, this fragmentation didn't just imply an obvious loss of sovereignty in the abstract sense, but also destroyed the economy. It fragmented the Syrian national economy. It created kind of perverse war economies in the country. And as you said, Israel has been bombing Syria for the past decade. This bombing escalates after the collapse of the government. They further invaded Syrian territory, and we saw the incursions and the devastation that took place in the last couple of days.
If you can talk about who Mohammed al-Bashir is, the man who's been appointed the temporary prime minister right now of Syria, and also HTS, its role, listed as a terrorist movement by the U.S., the EU, the U.K., and Turkey. The U.N. Special Envoy for Syria told the Financial Times that international powers seeking a peaceful transition in the country would have to consider lifting this designation. Who Abu Mohammed al-Jalani, now his birth name is Ahmed Shara, is?
Yes, well, I'm not an expert on Ahmad Shara's personal history. Some of that has come out in recent days about his birth in Syria. He claims he was radicalized by the Palestinian Intifada, and he joined Al-Qaeda in Syria and Iraq. And Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is basically a splinter group from Al-Qaeda that had basically come, it was based in Iraq, and then it came back to Syria after the uprising started. And there was a period of time